From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, February 13, 2009. The stimulus tucks away some $7 billion for broadband infrastructure, but will that money really serve rural communities or line telecom pockets? We'll hear from Southern Africa, where a cholera epidemic has taken its toll on Zimbabwe and threatens neighboring countries. And we'll hear why critics are questioning how effective a major Mexican military operation has been at eliminating the northern border drug trade. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Dissatisfaction with the state of the economy is rampant in Europe. The most recent country to fall victim to angry public sentiment is Italy. Today, 700,000 protesters descended on Rome. Federico Mastrogiovanni has more.
Workers, organized by Italy's largest and most important union, the CGIL, blocked the traffic in the capital today. Protesters believe the public is paying for the financial crisis. The general secretary of the CGIL, Guglielmo Epifani, is convinced the striking workers will succeed in forcing the government to make two changes to its economic policies.
Now it is necessary to save jobs. No one should be laid off, and no company should close. Because this economic crisis can affect both the international and Italian systems of production, companies that close during this crisis will not rise again.
Many of the protesters are also calling on Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to stop what they call an attack on the Italian constitution. Berlusconi is attempting to transfer more power away from parliament to the central government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Federico Mastrogiovanni in Rome, Italy.
A female suicide bomber in Iraq killed nearly 40 women and children today as they made the annual Shiite pilgrimage to Karbala to mark the death of the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This is the most deadly bombing in Iraq so far this year and the third day in a row of attacks against the Shiite pilgrims. Indian police have detained more than 100 people in the southern state of Karnataka for fear of violence on Valentine's Day. Some fundamentalist groups in the state have threatened to disrupt the celebrations. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Valentine's Day celebrations have always been a low-key affair in India. But this year, the occasion has grabbed the attention of the entire nation. The reason is a threat issued by the Hindu right-wing group Sri Ram Sena. The group says they will force any men and women who display affection in public to get married. They say such public displays are an affront to Indian culture. The fundamentalists have been known to use violence in the past. The threat has evoked severe criticism, and many are preparing to defy what they say is moral policing by religious groups. With battle lines drawn between the two sides, the authorities see a threat to law and order. Besides detaining nearly 150 conservative activists, thousands of police have been deployed in Bangalore to ensure peaceful celebrations. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Members of the U.S. House, led by Judiciary Committee Chair John Conyers, are calling on the Justice Department to investigate Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio is accused of repeatedly disregarding the rights of Latino community members in a letter sent to Attorney General Eric Holder and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Congress members said Latinos in the Phoenix area feel under siege. Arpaio has been widely accused of racial profiling and managing prisons with substandard humanitarian conditions. A U.S. House committee met today with FEMA officials to discuss how to better rebuild Gulf Coast cities damaged by storms. But as Sam Greenspan reports, the government is still a long way away from making decisive changes in FEMA's operations.
In a fact-finding session, Congress and heads of FEMA met to create new channels of communication between lawmakers and disaster assistants. Republican Congressman An Joseph Cao of Louisiana says there are no decisive decisions for a new course of action. But Cao is optimistic that with renewed communication that began today, rebuilding efforts could be better managed.
I believe that we came up with several proposals that are quite attractive. Our objective in trying to hold this meeting is to again start a conversation, to get the parties together, to start to get them to sit down to work. I believe that we were able to achieve that goal.
How these conversations eventually affect FEMA policy will have direct implications for many Gulf Coast citizens still trying to get back on their feet, As of earlier this month, FEMA had denied aid to almost 650,000, or roughly 89%, of applications from victims of Hurricane Ike in Galveston, Texas. The Obama administration still has not appointed a FEMA director. Sam Greenspan, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Students at Hampshire College in Massachusetts today rallied to celebrate the school's decision to divest from companies involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The action makes Hampshire the first college to do so. Melinda Tuhus reports.
The action was prompted by the campus group Students for Justice in Palestine, which ran a two-year campaign focused on United Technologies, Motorola, Caterpillar, ITT, Terex, and General Electric. After the Board of Trustees decided to sell the mutual fund containing these six companies and more than 200 others, officials issued a statement that its investment committee had voted to do so, quote, without reference to any country or political movement. It said all 200-plus companies engaged in business practices that violate the college's policy on socially responsible investments. Student spokesman Brian Van Slyke said today's rally was to make clear that the divestment was focused on Israel's occupation of Palestine. In addition to those six companies, he said,
we also identified 14 other ones that the college actually asked us to identify so we didn't reinvest in the occupation, which goes to show you that this was about the occupation. And then literally days before the decision was reached to divest, they started to do this research on the other 200 companies to depoliticize the issue.
Van Slyke said that may have been prompted by the threat of a pro-Israel boycott of the college. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
After months of wrangling, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are attempting to get the economic stimulus package to President Obama's desk by President's Day. Some $7 billion is slated for broadband expansion in rural and poor communities. As FSRN's Karen Miller reports, critics want to make sure that $7 billion actually builds broadband infrastructure instead of giving the big telecoms more access to government money.
Under the broadband expansion provision of the stimulus package, grants will be available to increase broadband infrastructure in rural areas where at least 75% of the location does not have sufficient internet access. The bill also stipulates that companies who get the grants must provide, quote, non-discriminatory services, which is part of net neutrality. These grants would go to telecommunications companies, which have some worried, including Technology Policy Institute senior fellow Scott Walson. He's concerned that telecom companies might misuse the grants.
How do you make sure that the money goes for things that weren't going to be done? How do you make sure that the money goes to new things rather than to just stuff that was going to happen anyway? Because if it goes to stuff that was going to happen anyway, well, that's just free money to whoever was going to do it and does nothing new. And so in that case, it's neither stimulus nor improvements to broadband. And that's a very difficult problem to deal with.
There are a few details and specific regulations of how the funds will be implemented, but the bill does have certain priorities written into it, such as preferences to those who provide the internet for the highest number of people. Communications Director for Free Press, Craig Aaron, says this is a step up.
I'm not saying we're completely out of the woods here yet, but what it's done is it's set the stage. It's laid it out there to say if we're going to spend public money, it's got to support these underserved areas. That it's got to go be deployed in a way that encourages openness, that encourages competition. Now the government will still have to write the regulations, but as compared to other types of legislation written over the years that didn't include those kind of limits and requirements, I think that this bill will support deployment in areas that are currently not enjoying the benefits of broadband.
Funds will also go to poor areas and underserved populations as well. According to the U.S. Census, people with lower incomes and minorities are less likely to have broadband access. Technology Policy Institute senior fellow Scott Walson says there needs to be clearly defined objectives.
If our goal is to increase broadband adoption in this country, that is to increase the share of households who connect to broadband, then you want to focus more heavily on low-income people. If the goal is to bring broadband out to the last areas that don't have it, which will affect a smaller number of people, then you want to focus more on the infrastructure side. And I think when people talk, they kind of mix those two things together. But it's important to keep them separate. That supply and demand are separate things. And I think if we're not clear on what the goal is, then people will be disappointed in the outcome.
The bill also includes provisions for companies to provide faster service as part of the expansion. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
So what does this final stimulus version look like? $789 billion sounds like a lot of money, but some economists say it's not nearly enough to deal with the crisis. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. He spoke with KPFK's Sonali Kulhatkar this morning and points out some of what might be missing from the stimulus.
But we could look at some of the items, the tax cut for moderate-income people. I thought that was a good thing. The benefits, health benefits for unemployed workers. I think the final version ended up being 50%. Earlier, President Obama had proposed 75% of health care benefits would be paid. Access to Medicaid for unemployed people was taken out. There were cutbacks. This is a big thing, cutbacks in the stabilization funds for state and local governments. I'm not quite sure why that was such a target, but that was cut back to a very large extent. Money for school construction was also cut back. So there are a number of things that were cut back in there that are real losses. But again, just looking at it, the stimulus bill, the biggest thing to me is just simply it was too small to begin with, and it got smaller because they talk about it as being $800 billion, or I think it was $789, whatever the exact number was. That's a little misleading because $70 billion of that is for the alternative minimum tax, and that's not really stimulus because no one ever expected to pay that tax anyhow. That's a fix that everyone expected. So that's not going to add $1 to the economy. So the main story is it's just not large enough.
Baker is also critical of Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner's $1 trillion financial rescue plan.
President Obama or Timothy Geithner, as Treasury Secretary, are very vague on what exactly their plans are. We're looking at a situation where almost certainly many of the major banks are bankrupt, and there's no obvious taxpayer interest in supporting bankrupt banks. We have an interest in keeping the financial system operating, so keeping those banks operating, but in terms of supporting the stockholders, keeping the top executives in their position, we have no interest in that. So what we may have an interest in doing is ensuring that not just the depositors, but the other creditors of the bank have their obligations honored. But the way you would do that, at least in my view, is you follow the example, say what we did with IndyMac. You, in effect, have the FDIC take them over and reorganize their debt structure. You take the bad debts. We did this back in the 80s with the bad assets. We did in the 80s with the savings and loans, put them in a bad bank. We called it the Reconstruction Resolution Trust Corporation, and sell them off to the public, and then you restructure the bank and sell it back to the private sector. But the shareholders take the hit. We don't have an obligation to protect the shareholders of Citigroup or Bank America or any of the other banks that are, in effect, bankrupt right now.
Baker was one of the first authors to write about the housing bubble and predicted that out-of-hand housing prices would result in devastation. He blames former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan for not sounding the alarm.
It was easy to see that we had a housing bubble, that house prices were way out of line with their trend levels. I began writing about the housing bubble in 2002, and at that point, house prices had risen by 30%. This is nationwide averages, had risen by 30% when adjusted for inflation. And we had 100 years of data. You could go back from 1895 to 1995, and over that whole period, house prices on average had just increased at the same rate as the overall rate of inflation. So when you get an extraordinary divergence like that with no obvious explanation, it should have been a clear warning to people. For whatever reason, you had Greenspan and others, and in fact mostly economists in the country really, insisting that there was nothing unusual going on in the housing market. And house prices continued to rise. The house bubble expanded till the point it peaked in 2006. Where house prices had risen by more than 70% after adjusted for inflation, and that created on the order of $8 trillion in housing wealth, housing bubble wealth. And that clearly was going to end badly. Bubbles burst, and there was no doubt that you were going to see a very serious downturn. You were going to see lots of people lose their homes, and you were going to see lots of problems in the financial sector because housing is a very heavily leveraged asset. That's even in normal times. People typically would buy a home putting just 10 or 20% down, but during the bubble years, they were often buying a home putting zero down. And then on top of that, the banks themselves became very heavily leveraged. So the fact that you saw a serious downturn, you saw a financial crisis, this is totally predictable. And if the government, particularly the Federal Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan's the prime villain here, if he had taken steps back in 2002 when it should have been evident that we had a housing bubble, he could have prevented this disaster. But he instead actually promoted the housing bubble. He kept interest rates low. He kept insisting that there was no housing bubble, that people like me were nuts. He adopted a number of policies that helped to promote the bubble over these years. So this is a totally preventable disaster.
Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Israeli soldiers shot dead a 14-year-old teen in the West Bank. Soldiers fired at the Palestinian youth during a violent protest in Hebron after identifying him as the leader of a group of teenagers throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers. Meanwhile, an Israeli aerial drone struck Gaza today, claiming one life and wounding at least one other near the border with Egypt, this just days ahead of an expected ceasefire. Israel claims the attack targeted militants that were planning to strike first. The fresh pair of Israeli attacks occurs in the backdrop of a severe humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Rami Almagari has more.
Today's attacks come on the heels of a dire humanitarian situation in the region, where thousands of people remain displaced due to the three-week-long Israeli war on the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, aid shipments into Gaza have been caught up in a dispute between the ruling Hamas party and the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in Gaza, or UNRWA. Sami Mushasha is a spokesperson for UNRWA.
And the message was delivered clearly to them that we are an international humanitarian agency. We are a specialized body of the United Nations. When we write up our lists that of people who need our assistance, we write it based on need and not based on political affiliation. They have no right and no business in interfering with our work. I think the message reached clearly, and they confiscated amounts that were taken from our warehouse in one occasion and from our trucks on the second occasion were returned to us, and thus we were able to resume our services and work in Gaza.
The UN spokesperson added that the closure of key border crossings in Gaza still poses an obstacle in reaching all those who need assistance in the coastal enclave. Meanwhile, sources within Hamas confirmed that Hamas negotiators in Cairo are about to declare an Egyptian brokered ceasefire deal with Israel, based on reopening six Gaza crossings completely for a period of 18 months. However, the ruling Hamas party insists that any truce deal should be separate from the pending Egyptian-mediated prisoner swap deal, where leaders are discussing releasing a captured Israeli soldier. Fawzi Barhoum is a spokesperson for Hamas.
This declaration would meet the interests of our people by lifting the Israeli siege, reopening our border crossings, halting the aggression, as well as extracting guarantees from the Egyptians for the Zionist occupation commitment to the deal. Also, a solution for the Rafah crossing terminal can be reached in an agreement with the Egyptians and the Palestinian Authority, as well as the Europeans, until a national unity government is installed.
Until an agreement is enforced, Gazans remain hostage to closed border crossings and a trade of fire between Israel and Gaza-based armed factions. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almighari in Gaza.
Zimbabwe's rainy season will likely compound the country's cholera epidemic. The waterborne disease has claimed more than 3,500 lives in the southern African country in just 6 months. Water and sanitation services have all but collapsed due to Zimbabwe's economic and political crisis, creating conditions in which this deadly but entirely treatable disease has spread. Davidson Makanga reports from neighboring South Africa.
The crowded Budiriro neighborhood of the capital Harare is amongst those worst affected by the cholera pandemic. Residents of the poor, high-density suburb have no access to clean water or sanitation. They use a nearby bush as toilet.
Once we help ourselves in the bush area, we will then get the bad smell there from the area. But we can do nothing about the bush area because we really need to help ourselves.
Simon Moyo has fortunately not contracted cholera yet. But the cholera bacteria, which infect people through contaminated water and poor hygiene, spreads rapidly in conditions like these. Water is a scarce commodity in Zimbabwe's major towns and cities. The country's steep economic decline has meant its water infrastructure has seen little maintenance, let alone expansion in the past decade. The past 3 weeks were even worse due to a job protest by workers at the government-run water management company, Zimbabwe National Water Authority. Humanitarian organizations are fighting a losing battle to contain the fast-spreading waterborne disease. According to the World Health Organization, 1,000 people died in the last 2 weeks of January alone, evidence that the epidemic is not yet under control. UNICEF Zimbabwe has been on the forefront, providing medication at command clinics it helped establish across the country. But as UNICEF spokesperson Tsitsi Singiz explains, their efforts are continually outrun by the disease.
We haven't been able to contain the cholera situation. Cholera still continues to be beyond our control. We're still battling to control it. As of today, we have exceeded the 60,000 threshold that we had anticipated earlier. Our response continues to be outpaced by the outbreak.
Urban residents rely on humanitarian organizations for emergency supplies of clean water. Combined Arara Residents Association Chairperson Simba Moyo says the state-run Zimbabwe National Water Authority has failed the people.
Nothing much has improved.
We are still getting support from well-wishers like UNICEF in Germany or Hungary, which is a clear indication that Zingwa has failed and we will continue to fail until they are removed from that level of providing water to residents.
The Zimbabwe government has proposed to return control of water management to municipalities. In 2004, Zingwa was given responsibility and the budget allocation for providing water, but not to maintain infrastructure. This left city councillors without resources for essential repairs. Presenting a national budget for 2009 last week, Acting Minister of Finance Patrick Chinamasa also allocated nearly $19 million to bigger cities to upgrade malfunctioning water and sewer systems. Far to the south in Cape Town, South Africa, an event aimed at raising resources to fight cholera in Zimbabwe is taking place. Organized by a coalition of civil rights activists under the Get Up, Stand Up campaign, the January 31st gig for Jig concert was raising funds to acquire bleach for the embattled Northern neighbor. Event organizer Lumumba Chia says the initiative, already getting donations from well-wishers across the world, aims to raise money for at least 100,000 liters of bleach known as Jik after a popular African brand by February 13.
The water issue in Zimbabwe is a problem, and the people might think that Jik is just for bleaching, but Jik is also good for water because you take a teaspoon of Jik, it will purify 25 liters of water, and after 2 hours then it's drinkable and it's fine. We've experimented it, we've done it, and it's fine. So doing this will do a long way to help the others who are still suffering in Zimbabwe. This is our own way of showing solidarity to the people of Zimbabwe.
The announcement that a unit government is to be formed after months of political deadlock raises hopes that a more systematic effort to sort out water supply will now begin. For Interpress Service and FSRN, this is Devson Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
The results of a major Mexican military offensive indicate an unprecedented number of drug and arms seizures and a record number of high-ranking drug lord detentions. Dubbed Operation Tijuana, the strategy seeks to eliminate the drug trade in Mexico's northern border with the United States. But 2 years into it, violent murders are at a record high, journalists are being intimidated by authorities, and human rights abuses are getting harder and harder to document. FSRN's Victoria Martinez reports from Tijuana.
If publicity and numbers are everyday indicators, Operation Tijuana is a big success. The number of drug and gun seizures have gone up, but so do the figures of violence. According to recent statistics released by the Federal Public Safety Office, over 6,000 people were killed in Mexico in the drug-related violence in 2008. And the state of Baja California alone had over 1,000 drug-related murders, of which 80% took place in Tijuana, border city to San Diego. San Diego State University professor and Binational Human Rights Center director Victor Clark Alfaro considers this strategy a big failure.
The activity of the organized crime have developed in the same trend that in the past, even there is more violence. And not even the militaries, probably you think that because the militaries arrived in large numbers by the beginning of 2007, the violence has reached new dimensions and new levels.
The forces work with impunity and little respect for human rights. In a gruesome incident, sundown January 6, 2009, a group of federal police went into the Tijuana riverbed, where an estimated 500 people live, many of them homeless due to drug addiction. A photojournalist who asked his name be withheld was near the sewage pipes when he heard gunshots and went to investigate. What he found, there was three federal agents torturing two men they had just detained. The journalist witnessed and photographed the agents ordering the detainees to take their clothes off, kicking the clothes out of their reach and then sinking their heads under the cold sewage water with their military boots. I spoke to the photojournalist.
And then they took the second guy, the guy who was on the floor, and they threw him with the other guy. They took the two of them and started hitting them and pushing their heads under the sewage water. By then, I had already hid behind the bushes.
The pictures he took were sensational and published in the front page of Frontera newspaper without a byline for fear of reprisals. Not long ago, a Telemundo reporter and camera person were illegally detained and intimidated by federal police. Midday December 25th, Claudia Orozco and her rookie cameraman were inside their station car when they were surrounded by 20 federal agents, all of them with their face covered by black masks and their guns in the air. Orozco did not obey their orders to give over the camera and their phones, so the agents came aboard the car and ordered them to drive to the hotel where federal forces are stationed.
They came in and sat in the back seat of our truck and said, "Bring them in, you are under arrest." And I said, "On what grounds?" "For disrespecting authority."
But they were not taken to a police station or a courthouse for a formal sanction.
That's when I realized their so-called detention meant they were taking us to the hotel where they were staying.
After being questioned at the hotel for 20 minutes and with the pressure of the media posted outside the hotel, the journalists were released. Orozco got a call soon after by the head of the federal police, who apologized for the incident and promised an investigation. But the police was not available to speak to Free Speech Radio News on any of these incidents. Dr. Clark Alfaro claims this increased violence and mutual distrust between civilians and authorities are not only making it harder for journalists, but also for human rights activists like him, who had an easier time documenting abuses in the past.
Nowadays, it's very difficult to document it, because in many of the cases where people was victim, in many of those cases, they were killed. Why? Because in many of the bodies that are found in our city, in some of those victims, the police participate torturing and then, together with the organized crime, killing these people. So you cannot document those cases.
Mexican President Felipe Calderón has made it clear that federal force involvement in the war against drug trafficking is here to stay. Congress is currently debating legislation that would broaden the faculties of phone espionage and new mechanisms to speeden up the process of arrests and search warrants. But the legislators aren't debating an inclusion of any anti-corruption measures or to hold the force accountable on abuses of human rights or press freedom. From Tijuana, Mexico, this is Victoria Martinez for Free Speech Radio News.
And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.